Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting across from Meg and Tom Keneally to talk about Power Game, which is book three in the Montserrat series. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, this book starts with a messy murder. It does have an axe in it, and I'm just wondering where the axe came from, because an axe has been involved in Tom's imagination before, a long, long time ago. Is this a recurring theme? Do I need to be worried?
Oh, no, I think you're going to get out safe here. You're talking about the chance of Jimmy Blacksmith having an axe in it. Yes. Is somehow a far more Agatha Christie-esque axe than a really dangerous.
We're just ticking through the weapons. You know, so far we've had poison, we've had an awl, AWL, and that book, which was the second book, Dad wanted to call it It's All In Your Head, but for some reason the publisher, you know, wasn't keen on that. And this one's an axe, and the next one is a gun. And then we'll have to try to get really creative with the murder weapons.
And the man killed is the sort of the boatman, the bosun of the island, who is the island's chief source of connection with the Tasmanian mainland. Yes.
So let's get back to where we're right at the beginning, because I think there's a good opportunity for people who haven't heard about the series to sort of get an understanding of the three books. I mean, we've got book three out now, and those who are desperate for book three, make sure you get hold of the copy. But those who haven't yet dived in, can you give me a bit of an idea of what it's all about and when it's set?
It's set in the mid-1820s, and the central character, Hugh Montserrat, is an educated convict, a gentleman convict, who in the first book solves the murder of the commandant's wife. As a result has given his freedom and has to go from penal station to penal station solving the more sensitive murders in order to retain his freedom. Otherwise they'll chuck him back, you know, they'll recriminalise him, make him a convict again. Problem is, in the first book, his very best friend is an illiterate Irish housekeeper who is about three times more intelligent than him or anyone else in the penal colony, and he needs to keep it with him. He doesn't think he can keep solving these murders without her. So they become friends, they team up, she becomes his housekeeper. She has a habit of hitting him with a cleaning cloth when she thinks he's being stupid. And away they go. So they are called in whenever there's a murder that they're worried about the local constabulary getting wrong, or it's a little bit sensitive, or the administration wants a particular result out of it. And if he doesn't come up with the goods, he'll be back on the chain gang.
And where do you place it? Is it you mentioned Agatha Christie before. Are we talking an enjoyable crime mystery kind of a book, or were you going hard? Because that period is pretty hard on people.
It's probably at the cosy end. Having said that, there is, you know, there's a reasonable amount of blood and gore and floggings and hangings and so forth. But
fishing all day in Sydney.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a strong emphasis on colourful characters too. Mm. The main suspect, the reason Montserrat is sent to this island with his housekeeper, who consents to come because she can read so much. She can't read literally, but she can read circumstances and get information that he can't. The killing is very much related to the fact that there is a Mandela of his time on that island. There were people as famous as Mandela who were convicts, and one of them is on this island, a really famous Irishman called Power, hence the Power Game. And really, Montserrat is under a bit of pressure to find that Power is the man who killed the bosun, isn't he?
Yes, because the authorities would love to hang Power, but because he's such a beloved figure back in Ireland and such a lightning rod, they fear that if they do, they'll spark a rebellion.
Right.
So they stick him in the most remote place they can possibly imagine, an island dangling off an island, dangling off an island on the outside of the world, and hope people forget about him. But they don't. So then when this murder occurs, they think, ah, here's a chance to take some of the gloss off him.
Yes.
So hopefully he loses enough popularity.
We'll show the US Democratic Party that he's not a saint because he's committed this murder.
I got the great pleasure of talking to Anne Buist and Graham Simsion recently about their book they wrote together, and the way they worked it out was that one did a chapter and the other one did the other chapter, and there were two main protagonists. One was a man, one was a woman, and Graham looked after man and Anne looked after woman. That seemed okay. I could work that one out. I can see how you could write a book together like that. How do you guys write a book together? Because it seems such a solitary thing to do and to involve someone else in it. Is it like an editor-writer relationship, or is it two writers battling it out, or is it like a TV script thing when you've got a room around and you're just throwing around ideas?
Well, do you want to answer or do you want me to?
Why don't we both briefly answer and see if our answers are close?
We tried the I write a chapter, he writes a chapter, I write a chapter, he writes a chapter, but we've got very different voices and we found that the end result was a little bit inconsistent. So what's ended up happening is that I write the first couple of drafts in constant contact with Dad, and you know, constantly sending him through little snippets saying, is this, you know, does this look okay, and so on, and then he and I then go over the subsequent drafts together. We often get asked whether we fight. And we don't. We're very temperamentally similar, which is good, because if you had issues with somebody at the start of a process like this, somebody would be dead by the end of it. But we don't tend to fight. There are minor disagreements on style. Dad thinks I anthropomorphise too much, but to the point where I now leave notes in the manuscript saying, yes, I know I'm anthropomorphising, deal with it.
Yes, yeah. Dancing, tendency towards dancing teapots. Mrs. Mulrooney, the other sleuth, is so obsessed or so involved with making tea all the time that tea is a big element in all these books. Her indispensable tea, source of refreshment and wisdom. And but we were going to do the alternating or the simultaneous, but it didn't quite work out, and I like Meg's voice, so I contribute via this. We talk very regularly. At the start it was daily, and then we write together, but the writing together bit is, or rewriting together bit, is very fast, because we get on. We argue about many things, but not this.
Yeah.
I'm the way it's developing. Meg does a lot of work, and I'm starting to get a bit guilty. But I do rewrites particularly a lot on the power game. So I'm still an author.
Yeah.
I'm not an editor alone, but there is a lot of exploitation of the child.
I'm delighted to be exploited, I have to say. Also, at the beginning, it's worth saying that we're both very keen bushwalkers, and when we're embarking on another one, we go for a long walk and flesh out the plot together.
That's what I was going to ask, that initial thing. You do have to be sort of talking about.
And we talk about where the sources are,
where
the books are about this, where the records are about this.
And then I ring up Dad and say, oh, I just found out, did you know, that I just found out, for example, that one of the characters in the current, the next Montserrat book, Montserrat 4, which I'm in the throes of writing the first draft of, that one of the characters had, that the man on which one of the characters based had fought a duel, and I rang Dad up and said, did you know this? And of course he had. And he said, yes, and you should also look at this and that. Yeah. And I'm always raiding his library, picking his brain.
I was going to ask you about that, because is this an area that you've always been fascinated, this time period? Is this something you've been fascinated with?
I have, but I don't know nearly as much about it as
the guy who wrote the book. Dad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
On Montserrat is based on Tucker, who wrote an early Australian novel called Ralph Rashleigh. Tucker was a gentleman convict. He was sent to Australia for something you wouldn't be sent to Australia. Now, he actually accused an uncle of his of abusing children.
Hmm.
And the uncle sued him for criminal libel. And he was sent to Australia for that. And he was visiting a woman in Parramatta, was out of his district, and so was recharged and sent to Port Macquarie. And that's why we put the first book in Port Macquarie. I was always interested in the female factory because Meg's got an ancestor, and my wife's ancestor was an Irish girl of 22 in the female factory. And then this Maria Island is a place that I went to years ago when researching another long-forgotten book called The Great Shame. And it was a place where they kept some Irish political prisoners for a time.
So you're Mandela.
And the Mandela figure.
Yeah. He's and based on a fellow called William Smith O'Brien.
I
got the two names, Smith and O'Brien.
Exactly. There you go.
I like to emphasise that not everyone was a handkerchief thief. Some were.
Yeah.
It is true, there were handkerchief thieves. But there were many convicts who believed that what they were being shipped for was not a crime.
Mm.
These were rural activists,
yeah,
particularly Irish and English, people who wrecked threshing machines so that they'd still have a job.
I remember reading in your book about the Australian history, I think somewhere a bit further west from here, but there was an uprising. I'd never heard about it before.
Yes.
But it's kind of a workers' uprising.
There was an Irish rebels uprising. Yeah. These were political prisoners in the about 1804, I believe it was, an uprising in Toongabi. And in any case, these things fascinate me. They say convictism ended at this date, but not all the convicts immediately accommodated us by dying. And many of them had children and passed on these attitudes.
Yeah.
And they were not always criminal attitudes. They were social justice attitudes. There were many people who were transported to Australia for what would now be considered a social justice issue.
Yeah. And Meg, when you took on this, I mean, it's a big deal. I mean, taking it. Have you had a long history in writing? Have you got past novels that I haven't heard about?
I've got past novels, but they are gathering dust in my bottom drawer, and they deserve to remain there. I had been a journalist for many years, so that's been tremendously useful in writing fiction as well. I still have a day job, but this is something that I thought that, you know, I had a go at writing a number of times and thought, well, you know, it hasn't worked out, at least I won't die wondering. And then many years later, Dad came to me and said, look, I want to write a book about a gentleman convict detective, a murder mystery, and I don't have time and it's not really my thing, so do you want to give it a go?
And I had one partly written that
I gave. He'd done about 30,000 words and chucked them over the table at me and said, here you go, have a crack at that.
what a marvellous thing. Amazing
opportunity, incredible opportunity.
I always knew Meg was a... It's so easy not to get published. Yes. It always has been. It's even harder now because there are so many parties to the discussions of the publishers. There are finance people, there are publicity people, there are marketing people, and the editor is just one of the voices.
Yeah.
I think I always believed Meg was a writer, and now she's proved it.
Did you, like, when your dusty manuscript's in the drawer, Are they very private things, or did you, you know, pass them over and say, Dad, read this, and my grandpa would, or what?
Yeah. They were good. They were like one of those novels that wouldn't get a good novel that doesn't get published. There are such things.
Well, there are thousands of them. This is the thing.
That's what the Vogel Prize is for, so people under 35 can put in their unpublished novels. And
the wonderful, at the moment, the wonderful unpublished manuscript award, which keeps, I think, the woman who wrote The Dry
Came
through that way, and Graham Simpson, I think, came through that way. There are other ways to sneak through.
Shows
you how much talent there is out there.
It's astounding now. In Australia, the smallest book market in the English-speaking world, except for New Zealand, I think, but it's a very robust market.
Mm.
And the craft of letters, I remember when Frank Morehouse and I started writing, people thought we're crazy to give our lives to writing, but now there are many young, and may I say, very hard up Australians who nonetheless pursue the craft of writing to our huge benefit. Yeah. And
I remember, God bless even at the time that I first started bookselling, it's by an Australian. No, I won't buy that one. Is there anything, have you got anything, and that girl from by a Grisham or their girlfriend?
Yeah.
And people would actually not buy an Australian because.
Yes, that's right.
But then Courtney and, I mean, even things that people like Rachel Treasure and who started to make money.
Yes,
What? An Australian can make money in the publishing
world? Leanne Morris.
Well, look at that now. I mean, but it was a slow process. But now when I looked at Last Christmas, and I was so excited to see, because I looked at the Canadian Christmas from one of the bookshops over there, and so much American stuff. There was hardly any Canadian
stuff. That's right.
And, you know, I looked at the shop fronts and our emails, and it's so jam-packed full of Australian content.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't, you know, very hard to even find an American or a UK book. It was just so full of great
Reads. Yes.
It's a great moment.
That's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And, well, I'm looking forward to Meg. Meg said this book was gentler that she and I have put together. It is in some aspects. There are a few ideas swimming around in there, but we're learning more and more about Montserrat, who he was sent to Australia not for accusing his uncle of child abuse, but for impersonating a barrister. Mm-hmm. He impersonates an officer of the court. And he is a man with yearnings. And by the end of the power game, he's going to have to be thinking about what the future will be for him. If he's unlucky, he'll commit another crime and be sent, so-called crime, and be sent to another penal station. But if he keeps on solving murders and keeps his nose clean, he might marry this this Irish girl, who's a fancy girl in the sense that she's rebellious, I must hasten to say, that she's a full-blown character, and he admires her. He meets her in the second book, The Unmourned, and he yearns for her while he's in Tasmania, during which time she goes missing. And that enables us to go on to the next book. Every book discreet unto itself, you can start them anywhere, like Joe Nesbo books about his detective,
there's a multi-novel arc as well.
I love that when you start putting all that together. And I always find that amazing that authors can keep that upper story going along and do all these small stories within and keep it rolling. And with the characterization, because when you start reading the history, I mean, life is really in competition with any author's imagination because that period is full of wacky creations
and eccentric types.
So how do you exaggerate, or do you just go, I'm going to? How do you keep it within the realms of reality with that?
Well, you don't. you often find that the stories that people think you made up are the ones that actually happened.
Yeah. Yes.
You make up the mundane stuff. There's a character in the second book, for example, who's based on a fellow who actually existed called the Flying Pie Man. And the Flying Pie Man would jog with his little hot box up to Blackheath to sell pies in the Blue Mountains and then back to Sydney, and he would, in his spare time, undertake what he called feats of pedestrianism, including walking the equivalent of 400 kilometres around Maitland Racecourse with a victory flag and a coffin at the end, so he was covered for all eventualities. And, you know, this sort of thing is the stuff that people think you make up, but yeah. It's this sort of thing that actually
and
happens.
And he was a well-educated bloke in the classics and so on, so if you bought a pie from him, you get a bit of Ovid or
some Plato.
Or the thoughts of Marcus Aurelius.
Those must be gold when you dig around
absolutely.
And go, oh, here
yeah.
we are.
You're like, oh. And so of course, you know, I love it when we uncover something that's like, oh, really? Oh, no, that's going in. That has to go in. And one of those was an event that is fictionalised in The Power Game, this Irish aristocratic rebel, an extraordinary escape that he mounted, a failed escape, which involved a whaler being sent by the Democrats in America. And for some reason, he, you know, in real life and in the novel, he finds out that this whaler is on its way. And, you know, it puts a tender into the water and they're rowing at him as he breaks free from his guard and wades into the sea. And I won't tell you how that particular scene ends because as
but
in history, so
in
this novel.
It,
but
happened,
it happened
in reality.
Yeah.
And there were Tammany Hall, the Democratic machine in New York, were very anxious for these particular prisoners, publicised them, and did stuff about them because they depended on Irish voters. Every Malcolm Turnbull would love to be in this position where he gets a new shipload of voters every week. The Irish immediately joined the Democrat Party. They were dragooned into it if they didn't join, and they voted faithfully for Democrat people. So you had Tammany Hall, the Democratic machine in New York, sending agents to Australia to help some of these political prisoners escape. If they told us that on dreary afternoons in the Februarys of our childhood, we might have been perhaps more interested.
That sort of really got me so cross when I reading such books like this, and there's been quite a few great novels recently about Australia's past, but then your Great Australians History series, none of that was. I mean, they made Australian history so dull.
Went to great lengths.
There's so much blood in it. There's so much juice in it, and they, you know, like Dad says, you have to really try to make it boring.
I know. It makes me so cross.
I know.
That's but, even without the relationships. You know, once you get into the relationships between men and women and men and men, it's even more remarkable. And this issue came up with a political prisoner in on Maria Island. The political prisoner was accused by the bosun in real life of having... The bosun had observed an apparently improper relationship with the commandant's wife or daughter. And so in the novel, he's killed, it seems, to stop him talking to the commandant about it. Yeah. And that's why Power is the... suspect. And it's very interestingly, like a lot of Irishmen of his time, Irish leaders like Daniel O'Connell and some of the people who were sent from Tasmania, had actually given up on Ireland and gone to serve with Bolivar in South America. So he was involved in the war against the Spanish. Power has been involved with Bolivar as a leader of an Irish brigade against the Spanish at a great a battle in the mountains, which is talked about in the book, in the mountains in the Andes. Mm. So every character you look at in Australian history has dimensions you would not otherwise have expected.
I've been reading up on Australian history, and especially with your books, those backstories and that people have been to America, and like it's like these wanderers, like especially when the boom happened in Melbourne, where people just attracted everyone from all over. And these were people who were opportunists and had been to South America and been to the US, had been wandering around, had joined Garibaldi, you know, had done everything.
Yeah.
There's something there in Melbourne, and they brought all this world culture into this one city. Meg, you have a book, and you said something earlier which I thought was really nice, but it doesn't require parental supervision.
Yes, I wrote it without adult supervision.
Yeah, I like that. and that's coming out in July?
That's coming out in July, and it's another book about history. This one is a novel, but based on a story which actually happened, based on the story of a First Fleet convict called Mary Bryant, and this is another example of why don't they teach this in school. This woman was Cornish highwaywoman, very swashbuckling. She gets out to Australia and she masterminds a plan to nick the governor's cutter, which she does, and then she sails it with her husband, two toddlers and some other convicts, all the way to West Timor.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, where they pass themselves off as shipwrecked survivors. Ultimately, they're recaptured, shipped off to London. Her husband and children die along the way, and then she is saved from the noose by none other than James Boswell, he takes an interest in her case. Now, Boswell was a bit of a Cleaver Green, if you know what I mean, a bit of a rake type character, believed in justice but liked the women and liked the booze, so there were lots of bawdy tavern songs about he and Mary doing the rounds. So it's
you just need to read his London journals.
It's not impossible that they had a bit of an affair, and then at the ripe old age of 29 she disappears from history. So, and why don't we teach kids these stories?
You know? I was amazed once I went to Yale. They've got all the Boswell papers. I was always interested in Boswell, and there is in Yale a sprig of native tea tree which Mary used on the escape and kept and gave to Boswell. And it's in Boswell's papers, and it's in Yale.
Well, that's just brilliant itself.
But they were the first people they found coal in Newcastle. They were the first Europeans to stand on the Great Barrier Reef. You know, just... and
wasn't that Adani?
No. No, they're the last ones.
Just where they wipe it away.
Exactly.
And Tom... In October or somewhere at the other end of the year, you've got a book coming out as well?
I do. I got fascinated by Mungo Man, a 42,000-year-old skeleton. I met the man who found him.
I thought you were about to say, I met the man.
Bowler. Yeah. And I know I didn't meet
old.
The man.
Talk about historical.
I am old. But I've written a book called Two Old Men Dying. And one is about the death of Mungo Man, because his death was the earliest ritual burial that we have, and was done by other members of Homo sapiens who cooperated, obviously through speech.
Yeah.
And all this is fascinating to me, particularly the megafauna that he would have lived in. He's a member of a community out there on Lake Mungo, and there were other communities of Homo sapiens all that time that had been long established in Australia. And so I'm writing about his death. I'm writing about the death of an old man about my age, actually, who's not me.
Well, you're not dead.
No, that's right. And I don't want the gods to get the wrong concept.
He's definitely not me.
But I did get a bout with esophageal cancer a couple of years ago, and I learned so much about esophageal cancer that fascinated me that I thought, well, this old man will die of esophageal cancer. I made him a filmmaker because all my life, you know, writers are not quite fully paid up human beings. And I've dealt with the world through the novel, and he's dealt with the world through his camera. He's a filmmaker and a documentary filmmaker. So he is that, but also Mungo Man had a layer between himself and his community. He was a special man too, and he's burial with ochre, anointed with ochre, the earliest such burial on earth, as we indicated his significance, and with a sacrificial fire that burnt, a cleansing fire that burned for some time near his body before he was buried. And he is a remarkable figure. I think if we even, you know, even if the politicians that say dumb things about Aboriginals really knew about Mungo and about the world he lived in and how it was sedentary and he only travelled for the things we travel for, pilgrimage, to meet other people, education and trade. I think the our view of Aboriginality and its antiquity would be riveted in place by his skeleton, which is such a gracious skeleton. And a tall man. He's not a little troglodyte. Like, he's taller than me. Yeah.
Very tall man, then.
Yeah, oh, yeah, lofty, they called him. But that's what the book's about. And then about the fact that we take on quests. Now, we all say we want a quiet life. You probably say it. But then you start writing.
Yeah.
Mm.
You go on a quest. Writing is a form of pilgrimage quest. And if you start writing with the eye on publishing, you don't want a quiet life. You want rejection, hardship, poverty.
As a meme I saw once says, teach a man to read a book and he reads for a day, teach a man to write a book and you condemn him to a life of paralysing self-doubt.
Perfect. Is that uplifting to end on? I don't know. Tom, Meg, Tom, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for the interview.
It was great fun. You can get the whole series of Montserrat series at booktopia.com.au, and you can get all of Tom's books, and you can probably most likely pre-order Meg's new book coming out fairly soon.
Which is called Fled.
Fled. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.